This is Growing Forward, the collaborative podcast between New Mexico PBS and New Mexico Political Report. I'm Megan Kamrick, a correspondent with New Mexico PBS and news director at KUNM.
And I'm Andy Lyman with New Mexico Political Report.
This is our last episode of Season 3 and the last episode of 2021. And we thought it would be a good time to address some things we haven't talked a lot about and look towards next year and next season.
One thing that sort of checks both of those boxes is the addition of a director for the state's Cannabis Control Division. Just to get everyone up to speed, the Cannabis Regulation Act, which went into effect earlier this year, established the Cannabis Control Division, which is under the Regulation and Licensing Department.
Several weeks ago, the Cannabis Control Division hired Kristen Thompson as the director of the division. Thompson, a former lobbyist, told us she sought the position after hearing Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham talk about the future of cannabis in New Mexico.
I've been working in cannabis policy in multiple states across the West, and it was listening to the governor speak about the potential for cannabis legalization, her hopes that is a benefit for the land, water, the people of New Mexico, really spoke to me to come from a place of excitement, and that it was passed through the legislature and not forced upon people by, you know, by a vote of the people. And that this was something she spearheaded, and it really excited me about the potential here. I was ready to move on my career from cannabis, and here I am.
I know we have a lot of listeners who are trying to break into the new industry, and I want to just quickly mention that we did ask about the status of applications when we spoke with Thompson in November. She told us that they are working through applications and that she's confident that they're on track for sales to start no later than April 1st, 2022.
As we've covered in previous episodes, there's a growing concern that new producers, meaning those who are not already in the medical cannabis industry, may not have enough time to grow, dry, test, and package their products by April 1st. That, of course, could lead to a cannabis shortage for patients.
We have heard over the past few months from some business owners, they're concerned about timelines and getting product in the ground. These are not existing licensees, new licensees, and processed and in stores when retail sales are slated to start April 1st. If they can't get started soon, they're worried about that. Do you anticipate any possible shortages in product when retail sales launch?
We are looking at the needs right now. And, you know, we can see what people are planning on growing. We understand, you know, it takes 4 months to grow a plant under the best circumstances. So it's definitely building out from there. We don't anticipate shortages at this juncture. We see what people are excited about growing, and we want to make sure that they have that time and that the labs have the time to get the product tested before the first sale is made. So that's the time frame from which I started to work backward from in the intensity around making sure that we get these licenses out.
We've heard from plenty of applicants or entrepreneurs that are sort of facing this. And I think it was Superintendent Trujillo that called it, you know, a merry-go-round, or she referred to it a couple of different ways, where they're sort of caught between local governments and the state government because those localities do have some leeway in setting their rules and zoning. How can the Cannabis Control Division help with some of these issues to work out what's allowed, what those municipalities can require of, and then sometimes they get caught in this loop where they're trying to sort of wait on both entities?
Sure. We are working with stakeholders, including specific municipalities. We are really working through not having those documents hold up the process. We know that, you know, they have their concerns. We continue to work to address the concerns of the municipalities and provide guidance to all of the applicants on how they can help push their municipality or get the answers that they need to process. But we are not intending to let those missing documents hold up what we do on our end. And that was a change we all, when I came in, that we all agreed to. We want to have a really smooth rollout, and there are lessons from everywhere, and we're not fooling ourselves, but I'm doing everything and have such an incredible team, and we've got the support of so many people just in the entire department, not just our division. working together to make sure that this is a success in the view of the governor and what she wants to accomplish, which is, you know, you've heard it multiple times, but economic development and some equity for people impacted by the war on drugs, as well as traditionally underserved communities and agricultural areas. That's why I'm here, is to fulfill that vision that this brings good things to the people of New Mexico and is a benefit to every community where folks are operating.
There has been some chatter on social media about what your lobbying ties to at least one company that wants to expand here might mean. Could you talk a bit more about how you will reassure folks in New Mexico that you will not have any conflicts of interest?
Absolutely. I severed all ties with any of my former employers or lobby clients, including selling of stock, so as not to have any notion of impropriety. It is a value that I have held throughout my career that I expected from any regulator, not just in cannabis, but I did food policy and all kinds of other things, that I hold myself and others to that standard. And that is what you can expect here in my role here.
It's no secret that here in New Mexico, water is a major issue in just about every aspect of life, and it's no different when it comes to cannabis. Even when lawmakers were considering legislation earlier this year, there were many conversations about how an expanded cannabis industry might impact the state's water supply. Megan and I spoke to John Romero with the New Mexico Office of the State Engineer. More specifically, Romero is the director of the Water Rights Allocation Program. Here he is explaining more about what the division does.
Briefly and basically, the Office of the State Engineer administers and all the surface and groundwater in New Mexico. So if you need a permit to drill a well, move water rights, build a dam, that's under us as well, you come through our office. So any use of water in the state of New Mexico, other than the tribes and pueblos, they're sovereign, they don't need a permit from us. But any other use in New Mexico requires a permit from our office. So we administer the water, we measure the water, we allocate it, we do everything with the water. So we're the water quantity people, not the quality. That's the Environment Department. A lot of people think we're the same agency and we're not. So we're water quantity. The Water Resource Allocation Program, or WRAP, W-R-A-P, it's the largest program. There's four programs within the Office of the State Engineer, and the WRAP program is the largest. There's also the LAP program, LAP, Litigation and Adjudication Program, ISC, and Program Support. So we're the water rights divisions. We have seven district offices statewide. We also, under the RAP program, the technical divisions are housed in RAP, and that's the Water Use and Conservation Division, Hydrology Division, and the Dam Safety Division. And we have what's called a statewide projects division, which is under WRAP as well. So we're basically the water rights. We're the folks that the public will meet when they come into the office to get a permit to drill a well, to if you buy property that has water rights, you want to do a change of ownership, or you want to move your water rights from point A to point B. Well, we're the seven district offices that handle that, but we do those movements of water rights. And then, like I said, the technical divisions, they help, hydrology helps the water rights with doing some modeling and doing impairment analysis and stuff of that nature. And then dam safety, we regulate dams, make sure they're safe in the state of New Mexico. And then our water use and conservation, they help out with giving us information on water usage and conservation issues. So we're involved with a lot of things that touch the public on a daily basis.
What specific role does the Office of the State Engineer play in this new cannabis industry, and or how will your office be involved in all of that?
Obviously, cannabis is a plant. It's a crop. It needs water. So you need to have water rights and water with the associated water rights to grow this crop. And the way the legislation was passed, they have to have valid water rights to get a license from RLD to grow cannabis. How we are specifically involved in this process is that all those licenses go to RLD, Regulation and Licensing Division, and they have a separate cannabis division that they just started. They send in those licenses to us to look at the water rights component of it, the validity of the water rights. Do they have water rights and do they have them configured correctly? Like, for example, somebody can have a water right that is maybe for ag use or some other purpose of use. Maybe it's for industrial use, but they need to configure it to be for commercial use as well, because that was specific in the legislation. They have to have the water rights. First, it's got to be valid in sufficient quantities, number two, and then configured correctly for the purpose of use. So somebody may have a water right that's an irrigation or ag water right, but if they're going to be doing indoor irrigation of those plants, you know, in a greenhouse, hoop house, they need to configure it to be commercial use. So it's something that was specifically put in the legislation. So we look at all those applications come into our office, we review them, and we respond back to the RLD. And then I guess they let the applicants know what if they can proceed through the process. So we're looking at the validity of the water rights and if they're configured correctly.
Is that commercial requirement for indoor grows, hoop houses, whatever, is that, that's true for all crops? Is that just for cannabis?
Yes. It is true, because for indoor use, the reasoning behind that is you use more water because it's fully consumed. When you irrigate outdoors, that water is, there's a certain component or amount of water that makes it back to the system, whether it infiltrates down into the aquifer or it flows off the field and back into the river so somebody downstream can use it. So basically you're consuming all that water, so consider it commercial use, and it's fully consumed. So that's why the commercial component comes in. Now, we would require any indoor use of water anyway to be configured for commercial use. And you can almost argue that there's a commercial aspect to everything. So you grow pecans outside, you sell them as a commercial component. Intel, they build microchips. They use water. It's got to be really clean water, but they use water and they sell those microchips. So there's a commercial component to everything. You know, you alfalfa, you sell it to dairies. So there's always the commercial use, but this water right has to be configured for commercial specifically. The legislature put that in the statute. And it's also in the rules that they promulgated after that.
What does your office know about the amount of water cannabis requires?
Well, it's still relatively new to us, and it's pretty new nationwide. The numbers we're getting, or the studies we're seeing, that it's right around 6 gallons per plant per day for the growing season. So 6 gallons per plant every day. That's kind of the number that's been out there, but there's other studies that say maybe we should use on a per square footage. It's you know, whatever the square footage is of your greenhouse or the land that you have, maybe you should use the square footage, because there's different ways to grow cannabis, you know, outdoor, indoor. So it's still not really, nothing's been settled, I guess, or one way to do it. We're working with a lot of different universities or entities that are studying this. And we've heard from New Mexico State that it's similar to chili growth. You know, what a chili field or chili plants would take to grow. So it's similar to that. On the square footage end of it, I have this, I had my water use and conservation look into this, and they gave me a memo and said, there's a study done by Berkeley Cannabis Research Center, and they recommend that we use on the square footage end of it and not the per plant. And they say that the study found that water use for cannabis cultivation is approximately 198 gallons per square foot per year for indoor use, and 80 gallons per square foot per year for greenhouses, and 11 gallons per square foot per year for outdoor use. So those are the numbers we're looking at. As you can see, there's quite a big range in there.
Recently, lawmakers heard from your boss, State Engineer John D'Antonio, about a lack of funds and staffing issues in your department, or I guess in the engineer's office. Does that cause a problem? Do you foresee a problem now that we've got this other crop to sort of monitor from the engineer's point of view? Is that something that's going to cause some problems down the line?
Well, this has created an extra workload or additional workload for our agency, because we're having to review these permits that come in, you know, for the water right aspect, for the validity. And we've received at least about 30 of them so far that from an RLD that they want us to review. So it's, to us, it's kind of like a unfunded mandate. There was no resources given to the agency to do this extra work. We've just take it on and in stride and do what we have to do. It'd be nice. I know the initial legislation had, they developed or set up a fund that with the money they make from charging, you know, the applicants, and this fund is for agencies to be able to tap into it. But we were left off that fund as an agency that could tap into it for resources. So I myself have spent countless hours, and a lot of my water rights staff, my district offices have spent time, you know, we've put together frequently asked questions form on our website. It's in our hot topics. So we've done a lot to try to facilitate and help and answer questions. We get calls daily on with questions on how they can do this or can they do, you know, asking us for almost to be consultants, and we can't be consultants, but we do answer questions, you know, on water rights and things of that nature. So our agency is under-resourced. You know, we do need more staff. I've been here for 27 years, 6 months. And back in when John D'Antonio was state engineer the first time, we had 69 more staff then than we do now. And workload has not gone down or even leveled off. It's gone this way. So that just tells you how resource stressed we are. We need more resources, funding for the agency. And, you know, maybe this next session we will be successful in getting the resources, but it's been tough. I'll tell you, even now during COVID, we've been open. The agency has been open. We've tried to be here for people to come in. They still need their permits for a well or to move water rights. A farmer needs to do something to keep his crop alive. And we've been coming into the office. We never shut down any of our district offices. We may have been skeleton crews, but we were here answering the phones and doing the work for the public, for the people of New Mexico. So yeah, that's an issue that needs to be handled, I guess.
You had mentioned in terms of the addition of cannabis to the workload, reviewing things for RLD and answering questions. Where else do you see these sort of bottlenecks happening with the lack of staff or funding besides what you've mentioned? Anything else?
Well, we have a backlog of just applications, which we're going to see more of these type of just water right applications. When somebody wants to move water rights from, let's say, point A to point B, or change the use, the purpose of use, farmer needs to irrigate a different piece of land, or a rancher needs a new stock tank, stock well. We've got a backlog statewide. This is throughout the state of about 500 applications. So all these new applications that cannabis is going to generate, they're going to have to get in the queue. They'll be behind the 500. I see this backlog possibly increasing, and then it just takes that much longer for us to get somebody's application out. And they want it. I mean, they want it quick, right? You know, time's money, and the average time for an application, if it's straightforward, you know, no issues, 6 to 8 months. Depends on the complexity and the what area of the state, if it's surface or groundwater. There's a lot of factors, but it's going to take longer just with the lack of resources. And we'll start getting complaints, and we're already hearing them when we tell people, okay, you need to do this, and you got to move water rights into this well and do the, configure it. And they think it's a come in and get your permit and walk out the door. And you can do, maybe for a domestic well, we can do that, but not for these type of permits that need to be advertised in the newspaper. Just the advertising alone, in the legals, is a 70-day period.
Can I ask, the staff shortages, is that due to a lack of funding, or do you just can't fill these jobs?
I think it's a little of both. If I had the resources, the funding was there, let's say the budget was there, trust me, I'd fill them.
Okay.
But it also is, we're having a lot of issues in the rural districts, like down in Roswell, Deming, Aztec, finding qualified staff, because you need most of these positions require an engineering degree or a degree in water resources or hydrology, geology, you know, some of the sciences. So it's hard to find qualified candidates. And then sometimes people have the degree in engineering or hydrology, but we don't pay enough. So it's hard to attract those people. Or we do get them, they come for 6 months to a year, 2 years, and then we lose them because we don't pay as well as somebody in the private industry. You know, and somebody, this is another thing, you learn water rights, you know water rights, guess what? They start stealing them from us, whether it's a municipality that can pay more, a tribe in Pueblo that can pay more, or a private engineering firm that can pay more, because now somebody's got water right experience, we lose them. So it's multiple factors that affect this. I can't say it's one thing, but it sure would help if we had the budget, because that would help attract people. We paid them better and to keep them and just to fill the many vacancies that we have already.
During the first special legislative session earlier this year, when lawmakers approved recreational use cannabis, we often heard concerns about large cannabis businesses setting up grow operations in northern New Mexico, where acequias and water rights in general are a really big part of life.
More specifically, we heard concerns that these large businesses would get variances for water use before they are officially granted access to said water. But as it turns out, there may have been some confusion there, and it seems to stem from that issue we heard Kristen Thompson address, that chicken and egg situation where many producers are in between local and state regulation.
One hypothetical example of that is if an applicant needs zoning approval, say, in Albuquerque, the city zoning department may ask for a state-issued cannabis business license first. But of course, the state can't issue that until the local zoning office gives approval. So the regulation and licensing department and its cannabis control division came up with sort of a fix. An applicant can get a conditional approval in order to move things along on the local level.
And that's where it seems the confusion over water rights starts. Romero said there is no such thing as a variance for legal access to water.
With water rights, either you have water rights or you don't. It's either valid or not. So I don't know what they're talking about variances. It did come up in Taos it was a water natural resource interim committee hearing. And I was on a panel with Superintendent Linda Trujillo and Paula Garcia with the Acequia Association was there. And they were talking about variances. And in my mind, water rights, there's no variance. You don't kind of have a water right or maybe have a water right. Either you do or you don't, and it's configured in the right manner, or you can't use it. Then it's an illegal use of water. So for us, there's no variances. It's either you have a water right or you don't have a water right. I thought from the conversation they were talking about RLD, maybe giving them a variance to do something, like maybe it's a security issue or maybe it's some other part of their permitting process that they were going to give a variance. But from the water right perspective, from our office, there's no variance for this. You have a water right in the sufficient amount, configured correctly, or you don't. And we're not going to give any variances from our office. That just opens up a can of worms. Then how do you back out of that? So no, that's something we won't be doing.
And there's no requirement when applying for a cannabis license around conservation efforts. Innovation and conservation is encouraged, as we understand it.
Always.
Would you like to see some more accountability tied into those applications to protect our fragile water supplies?
We always look to conserve water. It's an aspect of every application. So when we review applications, when people are moving water rights from point A to point B or reconfiguring new point of diversion or supplemental well, whatever it may be. One of the things we look at is it contrary to conservation of water in the state of New Mexico? Waste is a big thing. If we find waste or illegal use of water, we're on it as best we can. We're trying to stop waste and illegal use of water. So conservation is a big thing with us. And that's one of the things we look at. Is there impairment? Is it contrary to conservation water in the state of New Mexico? Is it, like I said, are you going to impair somebody? Is the water right valid? There's certain things we look at to make sure whenever we approve an application that it's that we're able to approve it and it's going to be valid and not hurt somebody else. So yeah, conservation is something we always look at. It's always good to save water. And it's in everything we look at, every aspect that we do here in the agency. If anybody wants information, you can go to our website, Office of the State Engineer website, and it's in Hot Topics. We have a frequently asked questions FAQ. You know, if somebody wants to see that, those are typically a lot of the questions we get. That'll answer a lot. Or just call our office, our district offices, and ask questions. The point I make every time I do something like this is domestic wells cannot be used for commercial, recreational cannabis for commercial growing, unless you bring a valid water right into it. Give yourself enough time to file any applications because it's not going to happen right there. You know, we walk in and walk out with your permit same day. That is not going to happen. A lot of people think they have water rights just because they may have a well on their land or they live next to a river or they live next to an acequia passing their backyard. Doesn't mean you have water rights. So you need to research it, look into it, and make sure that you really have a valid water right. And you can call our office. We'll help as much as we can. But those are the things that I try to tell people, that give yourself time. And if you buy a water right from somebody, look into it. Make sure it hasn't been sold off before. We'll tell you. But you know, that happens. Somebody sells a water right one or two, three times, and it's a problem.
It's like buying a car. Make sure that the title's clear, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Before we wrap up this last episode, we do have some cannabis news updates. The Bernalillo County Board of Commissioners last week approved a county ordinance that would require cannabis consumption lounges to be indoors only. A while back, we spoke with Erica Rowland, who is hoping to launch what she described as a cannabis country club that would likely include an outdoor cannabis consumption area. Erica told us the idea of prohibiting outdoor consumption areas sort of goes against the idea of embracing this new industry. Also, a state district judge ruled last week that purchase limits for medical cannabis patients are valid, which means that unless regulators make a change to policies next year when sales start, medical cannabis patients will be limited to about 8 ounces in a 90-day period, whereas non-patients can buy up to 2 ounces at a time with no limit on the number of purchases. Now, the State Department of Health is in the process of finalizing a rule change that would increase patients' limits to about 15 ounces.
Well, that sounds like a lot either way, Andy.
Yeah, I think it's a lot. And I think the issue here is not so much the specific amount, but it's that there's a difference. The sort of critics of this are saying, why can't we buy 2 ounces in every purchase just like non-patients can? So it is quite a bit. And of course, 15 ounces in 30 days or 90 days is still a lot. But I think it's just the principle of the matter.
One thing that's interesting about the county commissioner's decision now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the zoning in Albuquerque right now does not prohibit outdoor consumption areas. Am I right?
That's right. So it would really be sort of a very select few areas. It's the unincorporated parts of Albuquerque that this would impact. So if you wanted to open a consumption area in, you know, maybe not downtown Albuquerque, but in the heart of Albuquerque, it wouldn't be as much of a problem as, say, outside of the city limits. Erica Rowland, her facility that she wants to open, I think, is just near Paseo, just on the northern border of Bernalillo County, but it is outside of the city limits.
It is a situation that kind of highlights what we're talking about in a microcosm. Like, you have these, well, they don't really overlap, but they're right near each other. I mean, if you're in Albuquerque, you're in Bernalillo County, but if you're in Bernalillo County, you're not necessarily in Albuquerque. So you have, like, two different sets of rules you have to go by.
Those things come up with things like trash pickup, right? Where you might live in the county, so you have a different trash pickup. Of course, the city can't go pick up your trash there. Same with law enforcement, you know. And so it does get confusing, you know, where do I live? Who do I call? What rules do I follow? But yes, I think that just sort of adds to that level of it. And I think Albuquerque and Bernalillo County are sort of unique in that, because you can't really tell when you're outside of the city limits. You feel like you're in Albuquerque when you're on Paseo and 2nd Street.
Right. Well, it comes up in Santa Fe too, I guess, right? People could be in the county, they can be in the city. We have seen some businesses, depending on what kind of rule is coming down around anything, a minimum wage, whatever, they might literally move outside the city to be in the county. Or
yeah,
vice versa.
And I think a lot of people forget about that until we have issues like the Bernalillo County Commission coming up with new rules and regulations, and we're like, wait a minute, didn't Albuquerque just do this?
Right. I've actually gone to vote sometimes, and people show up and they think they're in Albuquerque, and they're not, and they're mad they can't vote for mayor.
Yeah, you could literally live across a major street and be outside of the city limits.
So what are some of the things that have happened around taxes this year as well?
Well, the tax issue with the purchase limits, just to remind folks, medical cannabis is now free of gross receipts taxes. But in April, when recreational use sales start, there's going to be a cannabis excise tax applied to recreational use cannabis in April when sales start, if not sooner. And so the issue really comes up is what the Department of Health is saying is if medical cannabis patients want to buy more than their allotted 15 ounces, if that goes through, they can just supplement that with recreational use purchases, which means that they'd have to then pay taxes on it. So I think that's where that principal issue comes up again, is you're saying, well, if patients can't get what they need in the 15 ounces and they want to buy that additional, then they would go ahead and have to pay that, you know, 20% tax.
Now, that's the state excise tax. The localities can also put a gross receipts tax on?
Right. So they would be paying gross receipts tax. And I think to start out with the first year, we're looking at roughly 20%. So you're talking about
a total.
I believe a 12% excise tax with roughly 7-8%, depending on where you live, for gross receipts taxes.
So this means that the medical dispensaries will still have to track purchases.
That's right. And when we spoke with Matt Munoz a few episodes back, that was his where he brought up that issue was, you know, if everybody gets to buy 2 ounces, then they don't have to track purchases. They just show their card to get a tax break. But now it looks like, unless things change, that they will have to keep tracking those purchases.
I should say dispensaries. There's not going to be specific medical dispensaries necessarily.
Probably not. I think in theory somebody could open a medical-only dispensary if that's what they want to do. Of course, you know, capitalism, and most people will probably want to sell both.
Andy, even though we did more than 10 episodes this season, I feel like there's still so much we wanted to cover that we didn't even get to.
Yeah, there is just really so much more to still unpack. One thing that we just couldn't get to was a closer look on a new loan program the state is expected to roll out early next year.
Yeah, that was such an interesting development that came out of this year. For listeners who don't know, the New Mexico Finance Authority, along with the Legislative Oversight Committee, just approved a cannabis microbusiness loan program. In previous episodes, we spoke with microbusiness applicants as well as financial institution representatives who said traditional business funding in this world is just not a thing, mostly because cannabis is still federally illegal.
Listeners can go read my story about that program, which we'll link to in the description of this episode, or you can keep an eye on the Finance Authority's website. They should have applications and more information up there in January or February of 2022. And hopefully we'll get a chance to speak with them about the new program next season. And speaking of next season, Megan, should we talk about our plans for that next season?
Yeah, we're still in the planning stages for season 4. I would really like to look into some of the innovation happening around cannabis. There are all kinds of products that people are creating around growing, packaging, processing, testing, and using cannabis. I'm also curious to see how this all rolls out on April 1st, what it looks like, who the players are. Also, we're already seeing some consolidation. We know New Mexicans are passionate about opportunities for locals, so I'm eager to find out if we can foster those opportunities while also growing this market with outside money. And I'm also eager to see how officials process those promised expungements. And if listeners have some episode ideas or questions that you would like answered, you can email us at growingforward@nmpbs.org. What are you hoping to address next season, Andy?
Well, something that struck me the other day was part of an interview that New Mexico PBS correspondent Laura Paskus did with journalist and author Sam Quiñones. His new book is about the ongoing opioid crisis, and it's called The Least of Us. Listeners can go watch that entire interview at nmpbs.org or on the New Mexico In Focus YouTube channel. But I want to play a snippet here for listeners where he talks specifically about the legalization of recreational use cannabis.
So looking into the future, as more states like New Mexico looks at decriminalizing something just like recreational marijuana, with your journalist's hat on, what are some of the unintended consequences, you think?
I could go on quite a long time about the childish way, it seems to me, the evidence shows that we have legalized marijuana. We have not legalized it with an attitude towards, if it's a food, if it's a consumable item, then we need to inspect it like any other foodstuff gets inspected and make sure that that's being produced in a responsible way. If it's a medicine, well, I know how other medicines are made. That's how marijuana needs to be addressed. I think we have been captured by what I think is really the next big industrial combine, which is, big pharma, big oil, big pot. To me, it makes very little sense in a time of climate change to allow marijuana, which grows perfectly well under the sun, to be grown indoors. That the carbon footprint is catastrophic, disastrous. Why is that? Why is that happening? Because it benefits producers like suppliers. And I think the big lesson that we should have learned from the opioid epidemic is this: be careful of what very potent legal drug you make widely available with outlandish claims of its risk-free nature. And that is what really was behind the opioid epidemic, making those claims for very powerful prescription pain pills. Therefore, anybody could do it. Well, same thing with marijuana. I think it would be wise to start by taking it down a notch, reducing the amount of the potency. Also understanding that just because we had this idea that we're not going to arrest people for marijuana sales anymore, the problem is if you're a legal dispensary paying taxes, you can't compete with someone who's selling in the underworld who pays no taxes, has no lights, has no expenses, all the expenses that you have, rent and all that kind of thing. He doesn't have any of that. And so we need to make a very serious effort to arrest those people. Those people will go to jail for selling marijuana. They're just not selling it legally, so that it benefits the dispensaries. I do believe in legalizing marijuana. I don't believe legalizing it the way we have is wise, is mature, is adult. And then of course also the tax money that, now dispensaries are saying you have to reduce our taxes because we can't compete with these folks in the underworld. Well, I thought that was what the whole point of legalizing marijuana was, to get increased taxes.
Right.
If I know our listeners, I'm sure there's some disagreement out there about what we just heard. But one thing that struck me, Megan, was the notion that states are not legalizing cannabis in a, quote, grown-up way. I've seen some improvements in terms of regulation here in New Mexico since I started covering the medical cannabis program about 5 or 6 years ago. But you and I have both heard the phrase the Wild West to describe the early days of that program. So I'm really interested to see how the new industry unfolds, and I'll be thinking about Quiñones' words as I watch.
I really liked Quiñones' thoughts on this. He's cutting right to the complexities around legal cannabis, from the THC levels to the challenges facing legal sellers if we let an underground market flourish. He gets at the economic challenges, but also the social challenges by criticizing the way it has been legalized so far. I mean, for decades, it was this kind of counterculture drug. It was forbidden. It was often demonized, celebrated by people protesting mainstream America. And now we're trying to bring it into the mainstream while sort of trying to keep that counterculture vibe or something. Any big changes like legalization will bring unintended consequences. But are there ways we can reduce those unintended consequences and really make this an industry that lives up to all its promises?
One thing we haven't brought up until now is how we managed to keep this going for 3 seasons with relatively little money. Of course, a huge thanks goes out to the folks over at the New Mexico Local News Fund who helped us launch this podcast with a pretty gracious grant. And thanks to New Mexico PBS and New Mexico Political Report for helping it keep afloat for these past 2 years and for funding a fourth season that will launch next year. But if you, the listener, want to help fund next season, you can find a donation link at nmpoliticalreport.com.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for your support and all the kind words we've received. We hope everyone has an enjoyable last 2 weeks of the year and a great start to next year.
And a special thanks to all of our guests for speaking with us and putting up with our relentless email requests. A big shout out goes to Catherine Connolly for designing our logo. But the biggest of all shout outs goes to our producer, Kevin McDonald, who has tirelessly made sure we get episodes out, sometimes just hours after we finish recording. Seriously, I don't think either Megan and I can actually convey what kind of superstar Kevin is.
He's definitely our unsung hero, keeping it moving behind the scenes. Thanks, Kevin.